Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
What if AI could help your business deliver mission-critical outcomes with speed? With IBM Consulting, your business can design, build, and scale trusted AI using Watson X, and modernize the way you work to accelerate real impact. Let's create AI that transforms your business. Learn more at ibm.com/consulting. IBM. Let's create.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome to Tech Stuff. My name is Chris Paulette, and I am an editor at HowStuffWorks.com. Sitting across from me, as he always does, is senior writer Jonathan Strickland.
Life's like a movie. Write your own ending.
I'm sorry, do you have a frog in your throat?
A little bit. So this is part two of our movie-making podcast series, and we're going to be doing a few more episodes about making movies in the future, although there'll probably be some buffer episodes between this and they, because we don't want to just turn into the movie-making podcast. But it turns out there's a lot of tech behind making movies.
Yeah, amusingly enough, we had intended this to be two episodes, one about what happens when you're making the movie and then what happens afterward. And as it turns out, there's probably going to be enough material to create many more of these podcasts. So we're going to just pick a couple topics today and in post-production, what happens after the movie has been shot. And, you know, we'll get through what we can get through and the rest of it we'll shelve until later.
Right. So future episodes might have information such as creating soundtracks, doing special effects, and actually just getting sound onto a film. We didn't even touch that in the last one. We had totally intended to, but 30 minutes went by so quickly. So let's look at editing films and talk about the process and how it started.
Okay.
So the earliest films were these static one-shot films. It was, you know, essentially the camera was set running, and then they captured stuff that happened in front of the camera, and that's what you got to see.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking like these are the earliest films, back when the medium was brand new, the technology was brand new.
The industry was being born.
Yeah. There was no such thing as a movie star at this point.
Right.
The movie stars were things like a train going by, that kind of stuff, because it was really proof of concept at this point. And it took a big leap to get to the point where we started to edit film. And by leap, I don't mean just technology, because actually the technology, at least the early technology of film editing, it was incredibly simple. It was essentially a pair of scissors and some tape.
Mm-hmm.
What the leap I'm talking about is a psychological leap. Now, it's hard for us to imagine this now because we've all lived in the era in which movies and television are everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But think back to – imagine that you are in the age – actually, you know what? Wayback Machine. Get in. Here we go.
Isn't that copyrighted?
All right. Our time travel machine, patent pending. Let's see. We're just going to set this to the beginning of, let's say, the 20th century.
Okay.
All right. And here we are, beginning of the 20th century. Now, we're talking about a time when entertainment was essentially you would go to a, maybe like a vaudeville theater and watch a live show.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're used to seeing are actors coming out on stage where you can see the actor. You watch a sequence from beginning to end and you get one view and that's it, right? Mm-hmm. You might change some scenery between scenes, but other than that, you know, you're watching a scene play in full, no change of perspective.
Right.
Film gave you the opportunity to use multiple perspectives in one scene. So you could have two people talking, but you could have the camera focused on one character for part of that scene and then take a totally different shot and focus it on another character for the rest of that scene. We see this all the time in any sequence that has dialogue.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
So you might be like over the shoulder of one character and you're looking at the face of another and then it switches views. Well, in the earliest days of filmmaking, no one knew that that would work.
Mm-hmm.
Because no one had done it before. No one had thought, is the human brain capable of following a sequence of events that are happening at different perspectives and make that one narrative? And it turned out, yes, we can. And once we were able to establish the fact that it doesn't really matter where you place the camera, it doesn't really matter where you make the cut, as long as continuity is preserved, people will follow and go along with you, and they have no trouble thinking, oh, well, this is a continuation of that scene.
Right.
But before we tried it, we didn't know. It might have been that you would cut from one perspective to another and the whole audience go, what just happened? I don't understand anymore. This doesn't make sense. I'm leaving.
And I'm sure there are people listening who are saying, no, that's not possible. Of course it was going to work out like that. But you don't know until you try.
No.
So, it's like science. You know, you have someone who makes a discovery. The next generation of scientists sort of take it for granted because it's been proven scientifically.
Right.
So now that we're at the point we are now, these things we could take for granted because we know for a fact that they work. But it took the work of the early filmmakers to discover that and allow us to build on that at this point.
Yeah, I mean, and there was really no way of testing it other than editing film when you get down to it. I mean, what mm-hmm. were you going to do? Put two actors on the stage, have one of them facing upstage, one facing downstage, deliver a line of dialogue, have them switch places and do it again?
Well, you know, today we might use multiple camera angles.
Right.
You know, with several different cameras, you
where
might
you
shoot
switch.
It from different perspectives
mm-hmm.
and have it all done that way. But, you know, back then it might not have occurred to anybody to do that, or it might have been too expensive for them to try.
Right. So a lot of the early films looked like they were just film productions of like a stage show. You know, the camera
sure.
pretty much had a view as if you were sitting in the audience watching a stage production.
Mm-hmm.
So let's get to the point where they figure out, hey, we can edit. We can actually take little bits. We can cut out stuff we don't need. We can switch perspectives. Everything's all right. Actually,
mm-hmm.
that opened up a huge world of possibilities in filmmaking.
Yes.
Because let's say that Chris and I want to film a scene where the two of us are having a discussion, and we have found this amazing room to film the scene in, and we want one of us to have a window to our back
where, okay.
with a beautiful vista. Unfortunately, the room we found, it's amazing, but it has a terrible view. But we
right.
found this other room that's terrible, but has an amazing view. Well, film editing, of course, allows us to film one side of that conversation in one room and the other side of the conversation in another room. It's taking place in two totally different times, in two totally different locations, edited together to make it look like a single time and place. And again, this was an amazing thing about film editing that had not existed before. There was no way of doing it. You had to have everyone in the same place at the same time in order to get something done.
Mm-hmm.
So, how'd they do it? Well, they shoot the film. They shoot as much film as they need for as many takes as they need in each location.
Right.
And then they end up making a work print of the film, so they're able to look at it in beyond the negative. They still have the negative, but they've made a work print.
Mm-hmm.
An editor goes through and views those scenes scene by scene, and then physically cuts up the film, physically tapes film together to create a new print, which usually we call like an editor's print or a rough cut. And then from that, you could look and say, all right, this is good. We need to shave a few seconds off this scene, or mm-hmm. This take is too long, that kind of stuff. It's a lot easier to cut than it is to add.
Yeah.
That's one of the big problems with the old version of film editing. Once you started cutting, you're really committing yourself.
Right.
You didn't have a lot of opportunity to switch stuff out either. If you said, you know, this other take worked a lot better than the one that you're using, it's a lot harder to switch that out using the old method of film editing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a really painstaking process. And, you know, it probably was a little easier for film editors than it was for sound editors when you had to listen to a thing and sort of guess where the tape was when you would cut it because you couldn't actually see it. But, yeah, I mean, we're literally talking about somebody sitting there at the board with a light, you know, the light table,
mm-hmm.
where you can actually see what's in each picture and then, you know, take the scissors, or I assume probably a razor blade, something that cuts, you know, pretty precisely, and splicing the two together.
Yeah.
That's, you know, that takes a lot of work. It's painstaking.
And eventually, technology started to catch up to this technique.
Mm-hmm.
That's when you start seeing editing machines like the Moviola.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So Moviola is essentially like a projector where it's a viewer to let you view what's on each frame of film. So you can go through and look at a print of film. And then it also even has the stuff there so that you can cut the film where you want it to be cut. And then you would splice it together and you could view it again. They're really loud machines. Old timey editors loved them. They swore by them saying that, you know, you would craft a film. You would build it frame by frame. And the editor was just as important a part of the picture as the director or producer. Because the editor really helped shape what the movie became. The director would do all the things about, you know, making sure people were giving the performances the director wanted, that kind of stuff. But the editor was the one who said, you know, this take is the perfect reaction, but it's a reaction to something that was said in this other take, so I'm going to be the one to combine the two.
That's right. Don't forget, the editor is important.
Yeah, I am constantly reminded of that fact.
I put a sign up in his cubicle so he doesn't forget.
Right, yeah. And whenever I do anything wrong, big red ink. So that's the old style of film editing, you know, the actual physical cutting of film. And some of that still goes on today, depending upon how a particular film company is doing a particular shoot. But a lot of the editing that you see these days, or a lot of the editing that movie studios are using, involves digital editing.
That's right. And, you know, of course, this has been made possible by the advent of the low-cost machines that we have today. Of course, it's a lot cheaper to do now than it would have been even 10 years ago. And a lot of studios are thoroughly invested in using the technology. Of course, using technology like that to edit a movie in post-production goes back even to pre-production. Because,
right.
I mean, in a lot of cases, they decide, the director and producer, I guess, decide who they want to use beforehand, go ahead and tell them, I guess, what they're going to do, what they have in mind. And then, you know, once they've actually done all the shooting, then they bring the material back to the studio. And of course, that could be either film or, you know, an actual digital version of the movie as it exists, you know, directly after it's been shot.
Right. Yeah, you can to do digital editing, there are several different ways you can go about it. You
mm-hmm.
can either probably the easiest way is you're using a digital camera to start with.
Oh yeah, because then you don't have to worry about any kind of conversion.
Yeah, you don't have to convert anything, you don't have to scan anything. You just port the data from your camera over into the computer system, and then you can start editing. You're capturing the video.
Mm-hmm.
You're capturing it from the camera and putting it into the computer. that process can take a while, depending on how high resolution you are shooting and the connection you're using between the camera and the computer.
That's
but
right.
But it's still faster than converting film to digital.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to convert film to digital, you've got a couple of different options as well. You can use something called a Telecine,
mm-hmm.
which it's kind of like a scanner in a sense. And some scanners are called Telecines and mm-hmm. vice versa. The terms are somewhat interchangeable, although purists will tell you that there is a distinct difference between the two.
Oh, sure, sure.
Telecine converts film to video formats, and you may have heard us refer before about the different frame rates of film versus video,
mm-hmm.
The 24 frames per second for film versus the 30 frames per second for video.
Right.
That's in the U.S., I should point out. That's not a global standard.
Yeah.
It's different in different regions.
It's a standard, but not the standard.
Yeah, it's a standard in the United States and a few other countries. So at any rate, because 24 and 30 don't match up quite right, you have to do some trickery to get them to kind of coincide more closely.
Mm-hmm.
And then that can introduce some jitter. This is why if you watch a movie that's been converted to video, let's say you were watching an old VHS tape or you were watching a movie broadcast on TV, mm-hmm. you might notice that it doesn't look quite the way you remembered it looking when you saw it on the screen.
Right.
And some of that's the conversion process. So
right.
Now... if you're using a scanner, some scanners, they'll just scan it in at the proper frames per second. Some Telecines do, too, at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so that you no longer have to worry about that. It's not an issue. And so you can digitally manipulate stuff at the same frame rate as you would if you were just working on film
right.
all the time. So you've moved the film into the digital format. And now you have two big options available to you.
Okay.
You can either use the digital media to assemble your movie in the order that you want it in, like choosing the takes, choosing, you know, the transitions, all that kind of stuff, and essentially making a video checklist for the negative cutter.
Mm-hmm.
So what you would do is once you've put your movie together, and again, the cool thing about digital is that it makes it really easy to switch stuff out. So let's say that, you know, you have two different, very different takes of the same scene, and you want to see how they both play out in the context of the overall film. It's not that hard to lift it one out and replace it with the other if it's all digital.
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard to do with film.
Sure.
For one thing, you have to pay more money just to get more film to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So you assembled your movie in video format. You hand that to your negative cutter. Your negative cutter goes back to the negative of the original film you shot and, using the video as a guide, assembles the movie.
Right.
So that's one way of doing it.
That seems almost as painstaking as the original version.
The middle process is not as painstaking because it is easier to edit once you or it's easier to assemble the movie in the way you want. That part is easy,
yeah.
Easier anyway. But yes, there is still quite a bit of manual labor that you have to do.
Hands on.
Oh yeah, yeah, and it takes a real skilled cutter to make sure that you get what you captured in video, because you definitely don't want to get to the point where you view the negative version, you know, when you've made a print and you think, wait, that doesn't follow what I made in the digital
right,
part.
Right.
So your other option, instead of using that as a guide, you can actually print to film from your digital video.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, what you do is you have film coming in. You manipulate it however you need to. You can do color correction. This is actually where you get the most freedom as an editor.
Right. You digitize the film print,
right.
The original of the film as it has been shot.
Right.
And you take the material there on the computer.
Right.
And then print it to film.
Exactly.
Okay.
So that way you can do things like color correction. You can do some effects. You can do lots of stuff that you could not do if you were just assembling the movie.
Yeah.
Right? Because, I mean, if you're just assembling the movie and making a checklist, it's not like you could insert a huge special effect in the middle. because you wouldn't have the film. The negative cutter would be like, all right, that's awesome. Where is this?
Yeah. You know? Well, that's something that I think is worth pointing out too. You can do things with color, even when you're doing, you know, a manual film edit, but it takes a lot more work because if you're going to do something like that, you have to go in frame by frame, you know, certain special effects and things that you want applied. And you've got a lot more freedom to do that with the digital process because you can add those things in the computer that you know, would have to go in hand by hand. And say if you wanted to, like all the famous movies that were shot in black and white and were later colorized for TV and things, you know, that has to be done, you know, if you're going to do that for film, that would be a real pain in the neck.
Yeah, yeah.
To go in and actually paint the cells, you know, or the frames one by one, that would be a real pain in the neck to do.
And there are entire companies that's all they do.
Yeah.
They take other people's films and then they do color correction. I mean, you'll see that in the credits of a movie. If you look for it, you might see that there's color correction by such and such company.
Sure.
But if you use this digital intermediate process, you could, if you have an editor skilled at this, could actually have the editor do some color correction mm-hmm. without ever having to go to another company. Chances are you probably still would have to, because if you're transferring back to film, then there's always the chance that just that transfer process means that you need to do some cleanup on your print before you start making copies. Mm-hmm. Also, I should have said there is one other option besides printing the film.
Oh, yes?
Yeah, distributing digitally.
Ah, good point.
You don't have to go back to film at all. In fact, if you did, you can either convert a film to digital and keep it digital, or of course you could use the digital camera and it's just digital the entire time. And in either case, you could distribute it digitally. Now, we talked about this a little bit in the other podcast. It makes it a lot easier to distribute the film.
Right.
But on the flip side, there aren't as many projectors that can run it.
Right. You have to have the equipment on the
theater side.
Yeah. Otherwise, it's sort of a moot point.
Yeah. You could send them a disc, and then they said, this is nice. We have nothing that can play this.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. If it's all the old style film projectors, then it doesn't do you any good. So as technology catches up in the cinemas, in the actual movie houses, that will become a bigger and bigger push, I think. It's just because of the ease of use. I mean, the easier it is, the more likely people will adopt it.
Right.
Now, there are those film purists who bemoan this fact because they think that it doesn't have the same sort of quality as the old films. And I can see their point. I mean, there's an argument to be made for both using the old style film editing and the digital editing methods. And it's two completely different philosophies and two completely different methodologies. When you're doing the old film editing process, you had to be OCD, really, because you had to be able to keep track of miles of film, mm-hmm. right? And you're cutting film, and you're going to have to keep track of all these different canisters of film until it's all put together. And it took organizational skills to a whole new level. I mean, you had to be an amazing organizational genius, really, to be a great film editor.
Right.
Now, a lot of that is done for you with computers. That's one reason why they call the digital process a non-linear editing process.
Right.
Because you can access any part of the movie at any time digitally. Once you've converted it into digital format, or if you shot it digitally, then you already have it. You can go to any part of that movie at any time, and the computer essentially is keeping track of everything for you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's not really a standard way across all different editing suites that allows you to organize your data in a standard format. So if you were trained on one kind of film editing software, you may actually have to learn a totally different style if the company you work for switches, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's not like they all have the exact same layout. So that's a downside. I was going to talk also just really quickly about the scanners.
Okay.
It's also a time-consuming process depending upon the equipment you have.
Well, if you want it to be of any quality, yes.
Yeah. So let's talk about film quality. Here's another issue. People
okay.
talk about how the quality of film may be higher than digital, and that was probably true, especially in the early days, but it's less true now.
Yeah, I mean, that's a fairly recent development.
Right.
I mean, just thinking about the quality of, for example, consumer-grade digital still cameras. You know, a lot of people were unwilling to make the switch to a digital still camera because they said, well, you know, it's just not as good a quality as my film camera.
Right.
But, you know, today, people take photos with their phones, the little cameras that are built into their phones, and expect them to be, you know, good enough to print.
Right.
Maybe not, you know, archival.
Yeah, maybe it won't be
quality,
blowing it up to the size of a building. But
right. But you know, of course, the people who are in the movie studios have access to a much wider range and much deeper range of equipment than you or I would have, because they have deeper pockets.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, it's still, you know, only been the last few years, a couple decades.
Right. And Chris sent me a really good article from Editors Guild magazine.
Mm-hmm.
It was called Digital Intermediate for Film. And in that article, it's discussed about the resolution of film versus the resolution of digital. So when you scan a movie in, are you losing resolution?
Mm-hmm.
And depending on the scanner you're using, yeah, you do lose some resolution. And also the higher resolution you're scanning to, the higher resolution you're converting into digital, the more information that, you know, the more data that requires, right?
Right.
So if you're scanning a film and you want it to be as true as possible to the original film, that's going to result in an enormous file.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to, and that also means it's going to take more time just to capture the film. So the example that Editors Guild magazine makes was that right now the what they call the gold standard for resolution in digital film is 4K,
mm-hmm.
which is 4,096 pixels horizontally by 3,112 pixels vertically. And there are actual digital cameras out there that can capture video at that resolution, at the 4K resolution.
Right.
Now, some purists will argue that film itself really ultimately could be up to 6K in resolution.
Mm-hmm.
However, that we're talking about that as a perfect negative. A perfect negative could be at 6K resolution. Once you convert that negative into a work print, you lose resolution. And once you start copying from the work print to make your prints a film that you distribute, you lose even more. So by the time you see a film on the screen, it may be closer to 2K than 6K just through the whole process. So while film at its ideal is a higher resolution than most digital video,
mm-hmm.
You don't see the ideal, so it doesn't really matter.
Okay. No, that makes sense.
So when you're scanning the film, you have to choose what resolution you want to scan it at.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're scanning, the higher resolution you use, the more information it's going to require and the more time it's going to require to scan. Until recently, that meant that it could take weeks to scan a film. For, let's say, a feature-length film, it could take weeks to scan all that film into 4K quality.
Mm-hmm.
It's gotten to the point now where there are some companies that have scanners that can, if you're scanning it at 2K, which, remember, that's the resolution that most feature films appear in and once you get to the theater. If you're scanning it at 2K, you can do it in real time. So 30 frames per second. It's not a problem. If you want to do 4K, it tends to be a little slower, usually between 18 and 16 frames per second. So you're scanning it in at a slower speed than you would be playing the movie.
Mm-hmm.
However, at least that's improved somewhat. So that's the editing process in general. I guess we could actually talk about what you're doing when you're digitally editing films.
Right, right.
I mean, you're cutting and pasting, but you're cutting and pasting pixels instead of actual film frames.
That's true. Actually, the consumer level video editing programs that you might see as part of, you know, just your standard, I want to make a DVD to send to my grandparents type of program, sort of like iMovie, for example, for Macintosh.
Mm-hmm.
I know there are several for Windows that do essentially the same thing. These are, you know, fairly inexpensive pieces of software, and you might think that they're very dissimilar to high-level programs. I'm sure professional editors would probably say they're completely different. But essentially, the screen that you look at when you're using these programs, if you've seen any of these, they're really not all that dissimilar. You have a video editing window where you can actually see where you are. It's like you would be, you know, looking at a particular frame of film. And then you have a timeline, and you can take different pieces of video and drop them into the timeline to create one long video segment. And that's essentially what the video editor is doing with that software now, or the movie editor, I should say. The thing is, you know, of course, the professional level packages have lots more capability.
Yeah, there are a lot more features. So essentially the stuff that you get on your home computer, it's really the same sort of program that the professionals are using. It's just a dumbed down version.
Yeah, because most people don't need all of the special effects and the ability to do a lot of color correction. It's sort of like the difference in, if you will, Photoshop Elements versus the full version of Photoshop. It's just, it's got far fewer features. As a result, it's more affordable to the average consumer. But, you know, if it's something that you're considering, if this sounds interesting to you as a career, if you'd like to get into professional motion picture editing, you know, you'd certainly get a feel for what it's like using some of these, you know, more simple programs. And then, you know, you can perhaps invest in some education and try out some of the more intense programs. I would recommend getting lots of hard drive space and a much more powerful processor.
Right.
You can never have too much RAM or processing capability or hard drive space when you're doing this kind of work.
Yep. And then you'll just go through the whole process of, you know, capturing the video from your recording device, whatever camera you're using, the editing process, and then rendering once you're done.
Yeah.
And then you've got your movie.
We just simplified a whole bunch of the process.
Yeah, rendering is easy. It takes no time at all. I expect Tyler to run in here any second. Guys!
Yes.
Yeah, no, rendering is what we call, that's the time when we walk into the video department and people are playing video games or reading books or throwing things at each other. They just turn to you and say, "We're rendering right now." And you accept it and you walk out of the room like it's okay.
Yes.
I tried that in my desk. I said, "I'm writing right now," and that did not work at all.
I can't imagine why.
Well, that wraps up a really good discussion about movie editing. And again,
we've got so much more to talk about. So, so we're going to put this research to good use.
Right. We'll have plenty more episodes in the future. But like we said, we'll give you guys a break so that you don't have to get overwhelmed by movie stuff too quickly. But
if there's a specific topic you want us to talk about movies, obviously we've talked about how we're going to discuss sound at some point and how they do that. But yeah, I mean, anything else?
And maybe eventually we will do an episode just on The Red One.
Yeah. You know, I'd really like to, just because it's, you know, apparently the hot camera right now in the market.
Yeah. So, if you have any of those questions, you want to hear something specific about movie making or just technology in general, you can write us. Our email address is techstuff@howstuffworks.com, and Chris and I will talk to you again really soon.
If you're a Tech Stuff fan, be sure to check us out on Twitter. TechStuffHSW is our handle, and you can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/TechStuffHSW.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. And be sure to check out the new TechStuff blog, now on the HowStuffWorks homepage. Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is, experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia, movement that inspires. Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey fam, I'm Simone Boyce.
I'm Danielle Robay.
And we're the hosts of The Bright Side, the podcast from Hello Sunshine that's guaranteed to light up your day.
Like our recent episode with sisters Regina and Raina King about the why behind their production company, Royal Ties.
We have such a huge love for storytelling without walls, without barriers.
Listen to The Bright Side from Hello Sunshine on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.